Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 16 of the Flight Test Podcast. This is another After Hours edition. This one deals with Full Scale versus RC Aviation. We had a good chance to talk with my dad as well as Bob Parmalee, who used to work together flying for a living, and their experiences with their Full Scale flight versus their experiences with RC flight. So it was a real good discussion. We also had Chris Roncaglione hosting the episode, and it was a really good time. So hope you guys enjoy.
Actually, I have not listened to the podcast yet, but I am looking forward to it because I've heard a lot about it. So I will be listening right along with you guys.
Very cool. And your dad's a pilot too, right?
Yeah, actually, I come from more of a full scale background myself than RC aviation. So kind of interested in what you guys have to say there. Also want to talk about, real quickly, I've seen some different comments on the forums and stuff like that. Just people talking about how the player on the website is not great and doesn't allow you to rewind very well, that sort of thing. So for those of you that have smartphones, I just wanted to list a couple different options of how to listen to the podcast that might help you guys out. Dedicated podcast apps are essentially RSS readers, or super specialized RSS readers, because most podcasts are distributed through an RSS feed. Anyway, is what these apps will allow you to do is to subscribe to the podcast, and then it'll download the podcast for you automatically when you're in Wi-Fi, if you choose to allow that. So next time you hop in the car or are working on your next build project, the Flight Test Podcast will be ready and waiting on you. The app that I use is called Pocket Casts, and it's for iOS and Android. Unfortunately, it's about $4, but I use it every day, so that's how I justify
it. Is it that much better than the one that comes on the iPhone?
To me, it's the best one out there, and I've tried a lot of them.
Because I'm still using the original one, so I'll have to check that out.
Yes, and it's an upgrade, basically, from the free one. But to me, it's the absolute best podcast player out there, and it's expensive, but like I said, I use it every day, so that's how I justify it. There's also free options. A free option for Android is called Player FM, so you can look that up. I'm not an Android guy, so I haven't tried it, I was just reading some reviews online, and for a free app, apparently it's pretty good. Also, there's now a free built-in iOS podcast player for iPhone that Alex was just talking about. Now, Apple's recognized the value of podcasts and has just made a free built-in app, which actually it's a pretty decent app for being free.
It works.
Yeah, it does the trick. So if you just search in any of those apps for Flight Test, Flight Test will pop up. Just click subscribe and we'll be there waiting for you for the very next podcast. So enjoy this episode, guys. I'm looking forward to it as much as you are. So take it away.
Thanks, guys. Enjoy.
All right, we are rolling.
Very cool. So just waiting on.
So yeah, it was pretty interesting Saturday. I mean, we were just in here just to talking and going to town and
yeah,
nothing.
So what exactly is it? It's like a.
I don't know how to explain it. It's if you go on, it'll tell you all about it. But it's called Blog Talk Radio, mm-hmm. and you set up your podcast. I mean, I got the FT After Hours thing and everything. It's all in there, and then you schedule shows, and you can schedule for an hour or two, whatever you want,
mm-hmm.
and then it throws it out on Twitter and Facebook and everything. Like you can schedule it in advance.
Did you just tweet on After Hours?
And yes.
Say we're going to be
right.
Here.
And,
so people.
Right. So oh, and man. And I only did it, you know, that day because this was going to be a little test.
Yeah.
So we tweeted it out and got going. And what's nice, it has when you get going, it has switchboard comes up.
Oh, cool!
All the calls come in with phone numbers and everything on there, and then you can take the live calls. But something in my laptop, because everything hooked up was exactly the way we had it when we did the Google thing and the Google Hangouts, and then Wayne and Dave and I came back down again. We were testing some stuff again with Google Hangouts and everything. Sure. Everything worked great. Everything was hooked up right. There was something in my laptop because when we realized that we took everything apart, unplugged everything, and we still weren't getting anything to go through the laptop. So yeah. I don't know what happened.
So somebody called in?
Yeah, because I had my phone sitting over there, And it was just bzz, 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 and there was Twitter was going crazy. Hey, we can't hear you. What's going on? Are you guys on? I didn't realize it. And then somebody finally called in. I'm like, caller, hello, can you hear us? And the guy's like, if you can hear me, we can't hear you. And I was looked at Wayne. He looked at me. I was like, oh, no.
Whoops. So, yeah, those of you who were trying to get a hold of Chris and yeah. Wayne on last Saturday.
Yeah. So we're going to we're gonna have to do that again. Yeah,
take two.
It was, but it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's not, if you were getting calls and people, you know,
right.
That's pretty cool that people were trying to reach out
and,
to you.
And we just kind of did it on like airplanes, you know, going over it. Because I get so much email and tweets about airplane safety stuff and mm-hmm. what can I do here and what kind of plane should I, you know, all kinds. So we were just in here just a yapping.
Nice. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's called Blog Talk.
Blogtalkradio.com.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, check it out.
So we're just waiting on my dad. Today we're going to be talking about – oh, there he is. We're going to be talking about Full Scale.
Yes, I'm excited.
So Full Scale versus RC, how they relate. This is the podcast that we this is the podcast that we recorded and unfortunately lost due to a corrupt memory card, which there was a couple different people who contacted me through customer support and said, hey, I recover these things. And I appreciate it very much, guys. But it's pretty much gone.
Right.
We had our guy, our IT guy, Robert, look at it. And he's pretty good about it. He's saved our butts a couple times with corrupted memory cards. And this one, there was just no luck. So thank you to all you guys out there who are willing to help.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're here today with my dad, Steve.
Hello.
Bob, who they have a history of flying together for a career, actually. And Chris, as usual. Unfortunately, Wayne is sick.
Wayne got sick. And
Josh Bixler's kids are sick. Yeah. So it's all this crazy weather we've been having. I was sick, but I think I'm getting better now.
Good.
But I'd still keep my distance.
Oh, nice.
So very cool. Yeah.
So, I guess we'll kind of reiterate some of the questions. This is kind of be like deja vu a little bit. But
Yeah, same podcast. Twice.
But Steve, I'll ask you again, you know, do you mind me asking how many hours you have? I'm just curious.
Well, I think it's still less than Bob's. I don't know about that. You're probably pushing.
Over 10,000?
Oh, it's around 15 or 16.
Ooh, that's a lot of hours.
What'd you end up with, Bob?
I ended up with about 16.5.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, when I retired.
Wow. And then you guys have traveled around the world?
Yeah, we did a lot of traveling for a lot of years. Bob and I flew together. Bob's career goes – well, I'll let him tell his story. Mine doesn't go back as far, but we've had a lot of great travels together. And now we still come back around full circle for some RC stuff every now and then.
Yeah.
We're in the same club.
What's some of your favorite places you guys have been?
Like? Well, they're all great. They're all fun. There's some places that you'd rather not go to again.
Yeah, I bet.
And there's others that are you know, the Hawaiian Islands and stuff like that. It's pretty nice when you get to go to those places.
We had some time layover in Alaska that we really enjoyed.
Really?
That was really some fun. Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot.
So that's always great up there. And, you know, warm spots in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you been anywhere warm lately?
No, not warm enough.
Not warm enough? I know. This weather's been so nasty. I got the free trip down to Daytona here next week, so I'm going to go down for a week just to get out of this for a little
bit. Good
for you. Yeah. That's awesome. Steve, I wanted to ask you, though, since, you know, you've been flying as long as you have, and I know I've done a wee little bit of flying. I got my instrument, but when I got in the RC and went down, bought a plane and took it home, put it together, and thought I was going to go out and just rule the skies with this thing, and realized after 30 seconds that, you know, I ended up in the ground and you know, I was like, this is way harder than what I expected and what I thought it was going to be. Did you have the same experience?
Yep, pretty much.
Yeah.
It's humbling.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think it's not going to be that difficult, but it is. It's a totally different type of flying. Basics are the same, characteristics, the skill, the lift and drag and
mm-hmm.
weight and all of that, thrust, all same concepts, but just different perspectives of how how you manage it with the, you know, the radio and the thumbs.
Yeah, and the reverse control when you're coming at you. That yeah. That hit me big time. Yeah. How about you, Bob? Did you?
Well, it's the same thing. You know, you understand the theory of flight and
right.
What you're supposed to do, but there's no feel.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's no feel, you're just watching it. And of course, then you get out there and there's orientation problems.
Yes.
You know, that you find that out
right.
real quick.
And I think it was just – I was just banging the sticks left, right, left, up, down, left. You know, there was no – everything went right out the window real quick. That was all I could do to try to save it. So what do you guys like to fly?
Well, I fly mainly aircraft, but that the thing lately is getting into the multi-rotor thing. I you know, for all the years I've flown RC, I'd never tried that, and I thought, well, this would be something interesting and mm-hmm. and good to do, and I've really had a good time with it.
So I'm still
mm-hmm. I'm still a real rookie. I'm learning.
But, what do you have for multi rotor?
Well, I've got a tricopter that the one that David first did, you know.
Oh, okay.
And then I've got the little
H quad.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I'm flying those two, and it's fun. You know, it's a challenge. And
now I've found I can go out and fly the quadcopters or the tricopters or whatever, and do pretty good, and everything's okay. And then I switch back to planes, and I'm all out of whack again. Have you noticed that or had that problem?
Well, I don't have that problem yet, but
no,
it seems, you know, the airplane's one thing, and then
the
quadcopter's another.
Do you have that problem, Alex?
Yeah. Especially when I fly fixed wing for a while and then I go back to multi-rotor.
Yep. It
takes me a while to get back in the swing of things, especially flying multi-rotor's line of sight. I think flying FPV is easier with multi-rotors. And then,
I could see that, yeah.
I don't know, the flight characteristics, the change in flight characteristics is a little bit to get used to when you're switching back and forth. And I tend to, like, only do one or the other. I'll fly multi-rotors for, like, 2-3 months straight,
yeah. Right.
Not even touch a plane. And then when I switch back to a fixed-wing plane, it takes some getting used to.
Oh, I know. I can't get out of that rut. I don't know. Bob, what did you – well, let me ask this. When did you start flying RC, roughly?
Oh, and when did I start flying RC?
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting story. My dad had a model shop.
No kidding.
Yeah, he started in the basement of our house, as a matter of fact. And we had a big backyard. So at this time, now we were flying U-Control.
Okay.
And we had a big U-Control circle in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody came to our house and bought airplanes and flew them in the backyard and all that stuff. So I was probably, I guess I was about 8 years old at that time.
Wow.
So and then, and that progressed, you know, into the early RC. Now, the real early RC, I really didn't get into. And I don't know quite why I didn't get into it, but I'd see other people doing it, and I tried it a little bit. But I really didn't get into that until later, when we started getting the better transmitters and,
mm-hmm.
and stuff, the digital and proportional stuff.
Now, is this back like in the Kraft radio days?
Oh, yeah, very
yeah.
much so, yeah. I had Kraft radios and... you know, when Curtis Youngblood was here, he talked about the single sticks.
Yeah,
and I had one of those Kraft single sticks.
Really?
That was a great radio. I really liked it. And then they quit
right,
making
right.
those. But
yeah, Curtis just loves that thing.
Yeah,
that's what he sets
right.
his up now.
Right.
It's just amazing yeah. what he must do with that to get that.
How about the cost factor like back then? Was it really expensive at, like compared to today or?
Well, RC flying was very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big deal. You had this big huge transmitter and batteries. Of course, batteries at that time, you know, there were the old wet cells that you carried with you, a big
mm-hmm.
car battery type thing to power the transmitter and then, you know, big battery packs that you had for the airplanes and stuff, and it was sort of a hassle. And you know, obviously, they didn't they didn't do much. They flicked the rudder one way or another and the elevator, and that was about it. That's about it. Was a free flight that you could have a little bit of control of. That was about what it amounted to.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it all gas back then or nitro back then?
It was nitro. Nitro? That's what we were flying anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There was some gas stuff around, but not much. Mm-hmm. At least when I was in there.
Roughly, like, what year are we talking, just out of curiosity?
Oh, that would have been the late 50s.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I got into my dad and my uncle bought an airplane, a Ronca Chief.
Full scale.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
So I got out of the RC stuff the model stuff for a while we were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started flying, you know, took lessons and stuff. And I soloed when I was 16, so, got in it that way. And like I say, I sort of left the model stuff go for a while, mm-hmm. for a few years, and then wasn't too long, we got back into it.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many times did you build something, spent weeks or months on it, and then took it out and crashed it? Have any of those?
Oh, well, the story there is, excuse me, the story there is my dad used to love to build the stuff, and I would take it out and crash it.
Oh, man.
And everybody used to give me a bad time, mm-hmm. about that. Say, well, your dad builds all this stuff for you, and then you take it out and crash it.
Oh, man. I can't imagine, you know, spending weeks and months on building something. I would just be shaking and be like, ah.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I could do that.
Yeah, me neither. I get nervous when I fly like a nice foam.
Yeah.
Like Durafly or something.
I know. Even when I know, Bob, you were saying before you were interested in getting the E-Flight Carbon Cub. And my first maiden flight with that, I mean, it's only $400, but still, that, you know, my first flight on that thing, I was nervous. Holy. And then once I got in the air, the thing's like a puppy dog and flies great. So I just.
That's a great looking plane.
Yeah. You haven't picked one up yet?
Well, it's on order.
Oh, it is on order?
Oh, yeah, I've got it on order. And in fact, I sent an email to Horizon the other day, and they said they're expecting a shipment at the end of February.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
no
it
kidding.
Should come, any day now, I suppose.
Yeah, we may or may not have a couple coming our way to flight test, too.
No kidding.
And they kind of told us the same thing. So maybe you can expect a video on the Carbon Cub here in the near future. Probably going to wait till the nicer weather comes
because
it's deserved. It's such a great, awesome plane.
Yeah, I got mine on skis right now. So
that's
got
to be fun.
Yeah, it works really good. And then when you do get yours, look me up because I got a couple little things I found on the forums, especially for like the battery compartment, the battery trays that the guy's been doing. It makes it way easier because the battery compartment's really tight. And I don't have really big hands, but, you know, and that takes a big 6-cell.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to get the battery in and out. And a guy, CNC machine, he built these battery pods. You bolt the main pod in, then you take the carrier, you put your battery in it, Velcro it in, it stays in there. You can charge it in there and everything, and then you just set it in and lock it in. It's really simple.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So.
We'll have to show that in the episode when we do one.
Right. The only thing I did find out though, the tires that come on it are phenomenal. They're great for any rough terrain or grass or anything, but they do not like anything hard. So I don't know where you fly or
well we fly off the grass.
Off the grass, yeah, you'll be fine then.
They're inflatable tires, right?
They're like a hard rubber / plastic type tire.
Okay.
And you look at them and you feel them, you'd think they'd be great, but they do not like pavement or any hard surface.
Do they just slide around?
No, they kind of actually hit, and you bring it in and try to set it down smooth, and it just wants to hit and bounce. And then and then pretty soon it wants to ground loop, and I don't know, but I've had no problems off the grass.
I know. I saw on one of the blogs a guy said he put balloon tires on it.
Yeah, a lot of the guys are putting the are those?
Dupro makes
the Dupro 6-inch inflatable tires. But from my opinion is they're really heavy. Two is the stock tires, I think, are over 7-inch tires. Now you're actually downgrading to a smaller tire. Now, if you're landing on a hard surface, maybe that would be the way to go. But I'll take the stock tires. They're bigger and a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to stick with.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that plane.
I haven't got it on the floats yet, though.
Yeah, so that would be a little.
That looks like fun.
Yeah, that does look like fun. So, Steve, what do you mostly fly?
Anything that's airworthy.
Anything, really, it doesn't matter?
That's pretty simple. I'm really an entry-level type person with the RC because of my limited time. So I'm good with the foam, strap on the batteries, and first thing I do when I get to the field is plug in my hot glue gun.
Oh, yeah.
And then go fly a little bit and then come back, do a repair, and change a battery and go out for some more. So I fly, I've got a Phoenix 150 that I fly and some flight test stuff, some of the three packs, a Spitfire, and I got a Nano.
QX?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
little
okay.
Little one to fly around the house a little bit. That's fun.
So, annoy the wife?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
it's a lot of fun. You know, so the simple stuff, the simple repair. Yeah. Easy to fly stuff, and I do a little bit of fly on the simulator a little bit.
Mm. So you don't have your eye on anything big or carbon.
I have fun with the little stuff. It's just as good for me right now. Maybe later when I have more time.
You like the Phoenixes from Laser Toys?
Yeah, those are nice stable platforms for me.
Little EPP. It's kind of like an EPP. Gentle Lady. It's kind of a polyhedral wing. It's actually just a chuck glider with a motor on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know.
And they make all different sizes. They have like a, I don't know, maybe it's a 15-inch all the way up to like a, what is the big one? 150. So
yeah.
I think it's 1,500 millimeter, I think, is what the 150 means. Mm-hmm. So and they all fly really, just two channel, simple. Mm-hmm. Soaring little plane.
So you might like the Radian then.
Yeah, he definitely would.
Yeah. That might be something you want to look
into. I've seen that. That looks like it would be
like $150. I mean, you can't beat this thing. Yeah. That may be something I think
maybe
you'd
a
really
Christmas
like.
Present.
I got a birthday coming up.
Oh, there you go,
Alex.
Yeah. There you go.
I built some balsa back, gentle lady back maybe 25 years ago or so, something like that. And then I bought a used trainer and flew that a little bit until it got busted up, and then moved on and. I never. Whatever happened to my gentle lady, Alex? Have you seen that around lately?
I haven't. Which one?
Well, yeah, I've got about three that are not in airworthy condition. But
well, it was years ago when me and my buddy, we were into RC cars at the time.
Uh huh.
So we figured that if we could drive an RC car, it would cross over. We
I did the same thing.
So my dad had he had a couple of gentle ladies and a nitro trainer. I don't know exactly which one, but it was balsa kind of built up. We thought it'd be a good idea to take the gentle lady up and just chuck it off a small little hill. And we actually did get a couple good flights in. But we kept throwing it harder and harder. And eventually it just kept soaring for so long. They're like building a playground or doing something up there at this park that we were at, and there's this big, huge backhoe or some kind of machinery, and the thing just kept gliding and kept gliding, and we didn't, it was so far away that we couldn't really tell how close we were getting to this backhoe.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it just clipped a wing on one of the big, huge tires and just like tore the ribbing out. So, yeah, I brought that home to Dad and actually, I don't think you found out about it for a while because
you did pretty well hiding that from me.
I put it you weren't flying that much at the time, so I just put it back where I found it.
Oh man, kind of like I know how you feel. I slammed the vegan into the house, for that.
Oh, yeah,
I didn't even think I was even close to that. I'm like. Yeah. What happened was
those things. The roll rate on those things are ballistic. If you don't tune it in,
right?
And even if you do tune it in, it still rolls like crazy.
What happened was, and it's not Brian's fault. It was completely my fault. But the way Brian was standing, David said a little bit before, he goes, "Hey, let's go down a little farther down, and we'll come around together, and we'll come up and do a pass together, side by side." And I was actually kind of waiting for him to catch up a little bit, so I went down a little farther, and what happened was when I was coming around, I went behind Brian's head, and I didn't see it for a while, and I must have bumped or hit something.
I think you rolled, because I've watched that footage a couple times, and I think you rolled inverted, and you didn't realize
right.
it.
Right. And I didn't see it. It's funny because O'Brien, he had me in the camera, and then all of a sudden I just come clear off to the side of him, you know, trying. And when I looked, I was like, oh, I got it. Nope. Man, I mean, right into the side of the house.
But, yeah, whose house was that?
That was Chad's neighbor's house.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Is he still a neighbor? I mean, a friendly neighbor?
Yeah,
he's great.
Yeah,
he's
comes out.
He's put up with flight tests since it started.
Yeah, he comes out and watches and harasses us. And, you know, luckily it was a foam plane, didn't do no damage, but it was pretty funny. It turned out good, though, because it actually showed exactly what
you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
I just completed my vegan. I'm just last night, as a matter of fact, I finished it. So we'll see how I do. But you just said something that clued me in there. The roll rate's pretty high. So
yeah, you can
pretty ballistic.
Cool, yeah,
cool it or
yeah, you can dial it. Yeah, dial it way down. Did you go with the 64 or the 70 millimeter?
Mine's 70 millimeter. I got a motor out of Habu.
Oh, really?
So
that'll work great.
It should.
Yeah.
It should. It looks good. Now I got to paint it and get it ready.
That thing flies amazing. I was just shocked the first time. You know, I was trying to fly it like a regular ducted fan jet. I'm all thinking it's going to tip stall. And Dave's like, nah, just shut the throttle down. You know, do a Harrier. I'm like, what? There's no way. Yeah, you'll really like
it. You know,
that
we were talking about this earlier and building airplanes, you know, like we did. We built Balsa and covered them. The early days, they covered them with silk and all that stuff. And, you know, what a job that was.
Right.
You spent a lot of time building. You know, and I got turned on to flight tests by a friend of mine who the episode was the one where they took the P-51 and they put the guy in there and had him all hooked up. And then the camera came off and down it went. And
David
that was
crashed it.
And the guy said, you got to see this. So I went on. But, you know, I've really got turned on to building these little foam airplanes.
Uh-huh.
The Spitfire just flies fantastic.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm amazed at how well they do. Everybody, you know, you'll go to the field and you'll fly that thing around. People say, boy, that flies pretty good. Yeah, it does. You want to fly it?
Yeah.
That's the nice thing about them is you can just pass the transmitter. You know, I mean, even if they crash it, you know, it's a couple hours of labor putting it together and maybe $4 or $5 of foam.
Yeah.
Or $30 if you bought the kit. It's way more gratifying. And Bob, you've built a lot of built-up balsa kind of stuff over the years, right?
Right.
And I think that says something so simple can be so gratifying. Throw some hot glue and some foam together in one night, and by the next day you can be out flying it. It's pretty gratifying.
And not only that, but it's just like that Spitfire. I've cartwheeled it a couple of times, you know.
They hold up very well.
A bad launch or something and cartwheel it. And it bangs it up.
Right.
But, you know, a little hot glue, like Steve said, and we're back in the air again, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing, you know, for just dollar foam board. I was amazed when they started building them how strong that stuff really is, you know.
It's pretty awesome.
It's crazy.
You get the wrinkles in it, but other than that, it still flies good.
It definitely has its downsides, but the plus sides of that Dollar Tree foam board definitely outweigh the downsides. Like, they're not good with water. Mm-hmm. You got to min-wax them or do something to waterproof them. But there's just the rigidity, how light it is. It's people say, oh, the paper makes it heavy. It's not. It's pretty light stuff.
Right. Right.
Super light.
Right. And for the price, you know, buy two of them.
You know?
I mean, really.
Yep.
So Steve, I wanted to talk a little bit about. I guess you got into. I don't know the correct term, ballooning, or what do you call that?
Ballooning.
So,
hot air ballooning.
Yeah. What?
I got my ticket last October. Did some training last summer.
Uh-huh.
And it was for a fixed wing, active fixed wing pilot. It's an add-on rating. So
it's not a
long process because you've got a lot of the
right
airspace stuff, the regulations, you know, the all of that piece. And it's really just learning the different category of aircraft.
Right. Now, do you have to do like a check ride?
Oh, yeah. It's the same thing. It's
same thing?
If you don't have a pilot's license, you know, fixed wing, then it's a written exam. But this isn't. There's a written exam for solo. you know, that you would go through the same process to make sure that you have the knowledge base of what you need to go through. But the training is there's emergency training, normal procedures, uh-huh. abnormal, and check right is a practical exam, and you know, an oral, you know, the oral examination where you sit there and talk for an hour and a half or so doing questions and answers,
uh-huh.
and then you go out and fly and you know demonstrate. Really, there's obviously no loops and rolls or
right.
you know, or lazy eights or anything like that. Uh-huh. But there are, you know, accuracy landings and control.
That's
and
what I was gonna. Yeah.
It's a buoyancy. That's a flight. It's in concept. It's the same as lift over weight. It's a buoyancy, and you trim up an airplane and it flies hands off. Balloons are the same way. You uh-huh. get the right temperature, and they're either cooling or warming up, and so you have to. You know, use the burner to keep them buoyant at the right level and temperature uh-huh. and such. So,
I mean, I'm fascinated by them. I talked to a guy. You know, we used to go down to Canton and watch the balloon thing. You know, right. for the Hall of Fame, and was talking to a guy. And that's, you know, they do. What do you call that contest? You know, where they come in, they drop the bean bags down.
It's accuracy contest.
Yes. Yeah. Never really thought much of it until I talked to a guy.
I lost my headphone.
You unplugged your dad. Didn't you? Or no?
Yeah, that one right there. The middle one.
This one?
Touch that right there somewhere.
There you go. Sorry, guys.
That's good. I got it.
You good?
Yeah. Back.
Sorry, I won't touch anything.
Don't touch it.
Shame on you. And anyway, I was talking with a guy and realized, you know, that they get the winds aloft charts, you know, and figure out, okay, we're going to go up at 5,000 feet. We're going to go this direction. Then we're going to drop down to 2,000 feet, you know, and how accurate that they can get those things. I was just fascinated by
yeah, it really is. There's a lot of technology in that, a lot of theory, a lot of strategies, a lot of technical work. It's a lot of work. And if you are ever interested in looking at the competition side of it, you can go to Alex's brother, our other son's website. It's called balloonpong.com.
Uh-huh.
And they've got the competitive side of ballooning involved on there. A lot of videos that they take and a lot of information and, you know, some scoring things. And
mm-hmm. They normally do a lot of live updates at the events because there's events all over the world. You and Joe, you guys went to, where was it?
Austria. Joe qualified for the Worlds in 2008 and went to Austria and competed.
Wow.
And came in sixth place out of 105 or so competitors from all around, the top competitors from all around the world. And it was his rookie, you know, it was his first time at the world. So, and of course you have to place in your own country at the nationals to get to earn the points and qualify for the mm-hmm. worlds to get invited to be on the
wow.
on the team.
Now, is that a full-time thing or just a hobby?
No, it's a hobby.
No
for
kidding.
Me, it's a hobby for Joe. He loves it. And for me, it's a part-time hobby.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can't do it all, but I like to do it all. So I dabbled in it last year, and Dan Greathouse was very supportive of that from Laser Toys. He has a hot air balloon, as you saw in the hot air balloon mm-hmm. episode in on flight test, and you know, he gave me some training, and I was able to use his balloon, and it was a great opportunity, and I'm really appreciative of that from Dan. So, thanks, Dan.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
Now, do they make a special like winds aloft thing for just balloons? It's more detailed.
They work in micro meteorology. It's like levels less than, you know, 2,000 feet, 1,000 feet, the winds.
Mm-hmm.
And they at these events, they have meteorologists that specify in forecasting winds for ballooning it. And they also send up pilot balloons, and they do readings. They can take measurements at different altitudes as it ascends. It's basically a helium balloon that they get angles and elevations and direction and such
mm-hmm.
as it goes up. So they can kind of get a read of where the wind is coming from. Because that's where you get up there, you just go downwind. You don't know where you're going to be.
Yeah.
But then they take this wind information and then they're able to strategize a direction
uh-huh.
to get to a target. And then they drop their beanbags on it, or they do trackers on board, GPS trackers that download their track and see how close they can fly. Sometimes they're airborne targets, so they fly through a donut hole or. They try to remain in a cylinder of airspace for a certain period of time. There's all kinds of all kinds of tasks that they have that they use to score points, similar to NASCAR racing or any other kind of sport, where they delineate the better pilots from the ones that aren't able to hit the targets as well. So
sometimes I know I've seen at Albuquerque they'll have competitions, and they'll have like a huge pole, 200-foot pole, mm-hmm. and at the top there's like a check with for like a cash prize or like a key to like a new car, and you have to try to play the winds and fly in and fly by the pole and grab the keys off the top of the pole, and if you can grab
really?
First person to grab it wins. So
wow.
it's pretty crazy, and it's you'd be surprised how accurate people can get, because a place like Albuquerque is what, like 800 balloons or six, it's hundreds of balloons, and obviously only one guy wins, but most of the balloons fly pretty close past this pole, within a couple hundred feet, and that's pretty accurate for not having any steering at all, just by playing the winds. So it's a pretty interesting hobby. Go ahead.
When you get that many balloons in such a small space, does it happen, or is it okay to bounce off of each other?
Well,
does that
I have
happen?
No idea. I've never been in that situation. I'm not so sure that's my.
Is that illegal?
Don't know. I really don't. I think there's balloon envelope to envelope touches in competition, mm-hmm. but when you have a basket to fabric yeah. Contact, then that's an issue.
Uh-huh.
It's something that the balloon world takes very seriously. It's a mm-hmm. safety piece, and it's not something they intentionally look to do. Does it happen? I think it does. Especially close to targets and during launches. Sometimes in the lane, if everybody's trying to get into the same landing field,
mm-hmm.
but it's very safe, all done properly, and sometimes they do have fabric to fabric contact, and of course you'd want to avoid the basket to fabric
right.
contact.
Right. Now, if you're just going out for a joyride or taking somebody for a ride or whatever. Do you actually kind of try to plan out, okay, obviously we're taking off here and then do the winds aloft thing and say, okay, we're going to try to shoot for this field over here?
Right. So it starts with the wind direction mm-hmm. and where you want to end up. And so you can, in general, that if the winds are out of the southeast and your landing site is at a certain spot, you're going to go kind of upwind and take off from that area so mm-hmm. that you drift towards an area that's got plenty of landing sites as compared to drifting towards a large metropolitan area that doesn't have many opportunities. And then fuel planning, if you did end up over a metropolitan area, you'd have, want to be able to have enough fuel to get to the other side where there are more opportunities for landing. So you didn't have to end up in a shopping
right.
mall parking lot. Where you tangle with cars, people,
yeah.
and light poles and wires. Yeah. And those are all things that you don't want, that you want to avoid.
Yeah.
You don't want to get involved with that. So
man.
So you kind of plan it so that you drift towards an area of multiple landing opportunities.
Uh-huh.
If you took off from a city area or the edge of a town or park or something and then drifted out towards farmland or maybe drift towards a valley so that come in for the landing, you get down lower, the winds are a little calmer down in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you might want to launch in the valley so that you can get up and the winds aren't going to be much of a factor during the launch period. And then as the evening comes along, the winds kind of die down a little bit, and an hour later, you can land, up in a normal field or a regular, outside the valley area, so to speak. And it'd be just as calm.
Right. Now, is there ever times like on a, warm summer evening you take off and you run into dead wind, dead air?
Yeah, it becomes what they call becalmed.
Yeah.
And you just don't go anywhere. And you pretty much take off and you are over the same spot for an hour.
No kidding.
Yeah, actually, I think in the balloon episode for Flight Test, they didn't go very far. It was super calm that day.
Right, and they were dealing with some of the water in the area, some from the Portage,
the
Portage Lake, but Berlin Reservoir, or what was it, that lake over there?
No, there's
Berlin.
Near
Berlin.
Yeah, and so they had to maneuver, the the ever-changing light and variable winds that night.
Uh-huh.
And if, you know, at one altitude, they'd get one direction and think that they'd be okay. And they come in for a landing, and then the wind would be going another direction.
Uh-huh.
And so they had to play that out. It was really a great episode. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that
in fact,
awesome.
Joe, our son, Alex's brother, our son Joe is in that with. He's the one that chucks the. And
the
in
glider.
Fact, that
was
another one of my gliders that disappeared. I'm like, where's my chucker?
Oh my gosh!
Next thing I know, it's Dave's got it motorized and or
it was a motor. He put a couple servos.
That's right. That's right. He just put controls on it. And
a tow. There was a tow release in it too.
And Joe threw it, and
I can't believe that worked out. That was so lucky.
Wow. And Josh caught it.
Oh,
that was funny.
That was a great episode. I'm just fascinated by the balloons. I mean, you know,
yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's I'm not an experienced balloonist or anything, but the thing I love about hot air balloon flying in a hot air balloon, it's the only form of flight where it's just dead quiet.
Yes,
because you're literally in motion with the wind. So.
Yep.
Even if there is a little bit of a breeze, there isn't when you're flying the balloon because you're rolling
right.
with the breeze. It's the only form of flight, as far as I know, that's just dead quiet. It's like
right.
you're sitting on a patio.
Yeah.
Really peaceful.
You know, a couple thousand feet up. It's really, really amazing experience.
Yeah. I got to go one time, and like you said, you know, the dead quiet. But I was amazed at what you could hear. Like
mm-hmm.
down on the ground, people talking.
Oh, yeah. Dogs barking. Dogs.
Yeah. I thought that was crazy. So
anyway, what's really strange, I used to fly sailplanes, and the same problem is that you hear other airplanes coming.
Oh.
And when I was an instructor in sailplanes at Freedom Field,
uh-huh.
and that's something we used to do to the other instructors, is if you were flying the tow plane, you'd come around behind the sailplane, so he's going away from you,
uh-huh.
and then you'd come at him, and he can hear this motor getting louder and louder, and he's wondering where it's coming from.
Wow. So do you flew the sailplanes then?
Oh, yeah.
No
yeah,
kidding.
I got quite a bit of time in sailplanes, and I was an instructor in sailplanes.
Oh, that's another one of my fascinations. It's on my bucket list. I want to fly a sailplane, but I don't know. I'm a little nervous about that, too. I watch videos on YouTube all the time, and I don't know, you know, how many times I've had to make a go-around in a real plane or something, you know, and you're in a sailplane, you don't get that second chance.
Surprisingly, it's pretty simple.
Yeah.
Once you learn it, and the sailplanes are so maneuverable that you can bring them right in,
uh-huh.
and it's really not a problem.
Yeah, there's a couple of YouTube videos I seen. I think it was in Europe, but a couple guys, they didn't make it, and they were landed out way out in somebody's field. I mean, they were in like it wasn't a cornfield, but like an oat field or something. And I thought, how are they going to get this thing out of here?
Well, when we were at Freedom Field, we had a pretty big glider club there. They've since moved to Wadsworth Airport. But those guys, they take off. You tow them up about noon. At 5 o'clock, here they come back. They've been up that whole time.
You got to be kidding.
Oh, no. They'd be, you know, you'd talk to them. How'd you go? Well, I went out here for 50 miles, and I went this way for 25. And then they usually made a big triangle or something. And some of them did land off field. They'd land off field, then they'd call, and sort of like the balloon. Then you had to get the trailer and go out. People go out and pick, you know, they take the thing apart, put it in the trailer, and bring it back.
Now with the sailplanes, is it kind of like the RC sailplanes where you're kind of looking for that certain conditions, like maybe, you know, like say I go out with my RC sailplane, I'm looking for the big cumulus clouds and looking, you know, for the big thermals, and is that same concept?
Same concept,
yeah.
And you can see the little dust devils
uh-huh.
on the ground that are marks them sometimes, and of course you have the instrumentation on board too. That tells you when you're in lift or you're in sink.
Yeah, the variometers.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can
uh-huh.
you can stay up. It's amazing how. And I'll tell you what, one of the thrills of my life was getting into a lift one time where we were going up 2,000 feet a minute.
What kind of?
And I mean, that was I can't describe what a thrill that was.
Wow.
And you just had it in a steep bank, and this thing's going up 2,000 feet a minute.
Wow.
So obviously they're not pressurized, but what kind of altitude can you...
Well, we only went to, I don't know, we started in that about 3,000 feet and kicked out of it about 7,000 feet.
No kidding.
Yeah. and we're right at the base of the cloud.
Unbelievable.
A lot of them have oxygen, don't they?
They do, and a lot of them that set altitude records. When we had a fellow there at Freedom Field, he was a pretty famous guy around Akron, Joe Kahn, and he went out to Colorado and soared on the ridge soaring off of the mountains, and he went to 33,000 feet, I think.
Holy cow, that'd be scary.
That'd be scary. Well, here's the problem. He said what happened is you're in this thing, and you're going up, and you have oxygen because they rigged that, and you get an award for going, you know, so gaining so many thousand feet, and I don't remember what it was now, but the cockpit starts to frost over on the inside. And he said he couldn't see.
Wow.
Because, you know, you're breathing, of right. course, and that air's going out in that cockpit, and it starts to frost over because it's so cold.
Yeah, I never even thought about it. What do they do for heat, though, on the inside? I guess he had to be dressed awfully warm. No.
They do.
Yeah.
And he said even then he was cold because you're not moving.
Right.
You're just sitting there, and you know, you hope you're staying in. The idea was to stay in the sun.
Uh-huh.
And he said, but there was times he was under the clouds, and that's when this would start happening, and then it would start frosting over.
Oh, man. That's crazy.
It is pretty crazy.
But it would be interesting to do. I often thought I'd love to try that sometime.
Yeah.
Wow. One of my favorite YouTube channels is For Sail Plane. I'd like to look at that sometimes when I'm just kind of relaxing is his name is Bruno Vassel. Like, mm-hmm. It's V-A-S-S-E-L. I think so. If you do a search on that, so he's got a lot of great video.
I'll post it in the show notes.
Yeah, that's good. He has some really great video that he puts up, some onboard cameras, and just speaks a lot about what's going on with the gliders. It's very educational, and it speaks a lot to some of these theories. And out there where he flies in Utah, there's a lot of ridge soaring and, you know, some thermal probably, but a lot of ridge soaring and such. And they go long, long distances. It's really amazing.
The latest thing I've been watching, it's big in Europe right now, and especially on the TV, and I guess they're trying to bring it over here, is the sailplane air racing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the YouTube videos of those guys. You know, one guy's on this side of the mountain, this guy's on the other. And, I mean, these things are hauling.
Right. And they're tracking and onboard videos and live video streams and all that to bring some elevate the awareness of that sport.
Yeah.
That'll be really, really neat when they get that going.
Right. I bet Red Bull. I'm sure Red Bull's probably their sponsor.
Could be, yeah. But some of the videos they got online are just, I mean, I couldn't believe how fast them things were going.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, some of the fastest RC flight is gliders.
Yeah,
those I don't even know.
Like the DS gliders.
Yeah,
like off the slopes and stuff. Mm-hmm. They're 200 miles an hour.
I think they're like 300
now.
Yeah.
Wow,
that's keeps going up.
Full carbon fiber wings and
just zipping around in a fast circle right on the lip of the.
That's scary.
Yeah, I would not
even know how they do that.
I don't know, Steve. Were you with me? We were out at Torrey Pines. With that time, we went to the glider port out there, which is right next to the golf course, if anybody's ever watched that golf tournament. And the guys are flying those parasails.
Right.
And then there's a whole bunch of RC guys flying the RC stuff off of the slope there.
Uh-huh.
And that was pretty interesting. I'd never seen that before. And they had some scale stuff and some big gliders and stuff that they were flying.
Slope soaring. You know.
Yeah. And it was really interesting. I'd never watched them do that. And, of course, occasionally they end up down at the bottom and have to go 300 feet down on that thing. And then they'd have to go down after it.
But. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, I'd like to try that with like a FT Spitfire just balance it out, maybe even put a GoPro in the front and just take it to a nice slope. I guess there's a slope competition every year up on Lake Erie somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I think it's up off of Edgewater Park, I think.
I would love to go there. I've always wanted to try slope soaring. And you see people who take regular models and just take the motor out, make sure it's balanced right, and then you can slope soar as long as you keep your airspeed up. I think that'd be good.
Yeah.
Going back to gliders another subject, you guys have experience towing gliders too, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
both RC and full scale.
Well, RC, that's something I'm going to do this year. That carbon cup.
Yes.
Yep. And I build a simple soar.
Uh huh.
And we're gonna tow that thing because I wanted to learn how to to do it. So yeah. We've talked about it. We're gonna try that this spring.
I bet that cub would tow four of those.
Oh, I think it will. Yeah, because I've seen the picture of it. They towed two or three of
K8s.
Yeah. Cool.
So I think it would do that no problem. But yeah, it's there. It's very when you're towing a sailplane. You're very vulnerable
mm-hmm.
because this guy in the real airplane, you're towing him from the tail and not the center of gravity like you do in the RC.
Mm-hmm.
So he has control over you. If he climbs, he pushes your nose down, and if he goes down, he pulls your nose up. So one time up at Freedom Field, that's where I was doing this, and I took a guy up. And he was I wouldn't call him a rookie, but he was sure not an experienced pilot. And what they're supposed to do is when they're never supposed to release and when the rope is not taut,
mm-hmm.
because you want to feel that release.
Right.
Well, they're supposed to pull up a little bit and then release. Well, this fella, he pulled up, pulled his release, and it didn't release. So now he's taking me over the top. In other words, I'm going down,
right,
and he's getting pulled over the top of me. And finally, when I fell forward, you know, of course, you only have a lap belt on.
Yeah.
At that time, we didn't have shoulder harnesses. So when I fell forward, I reached out and I released him.
Uh-huh.
And down we come and we land. And it was pretty exciting. He landed and we had bent the wings on that glider.
Really?
Yeah, it had to be sent back to the factory, and
wow.
And they were stressed for like 8 or 9 G's of wings.
Wow, that's intense.
Wow,
yeah.
that is crazy. So he said he had a wild ride behind there. Then I take it.
Well, he didn't have much to say.
He didn't
at
have
all.
Much to say. He had to take a quick trip home after that, huh? Oh my gosh.
What about you, Dad?
I towed some for a couple seasons back in the late 70s, early 80s.
That was some of your first hours,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, building some experience, you know, getting some flight time and interested in soaring. And I did fly the gliders, too. I never got my license. I did solo and quite a bit and towed a lot. You know, you earn your tows. And then the club back then, it was you'd tow 10 times, you get one free tow up in the glider, and that was your pay.
Oh my God!
There was some, you know, hot days that made it difficult for that. I flew a Citabria. That was what we were towing uh-huh. with at the time, a tired old raggedy Citabria that was fun to fly, but sure didn't go up very fast on those hot days, and you always wondered if you're going to make it past that line of trees that was a half a mile off the end of the runway. If you make it past that, then you'd work your way up. Sometimes I think the gliders were on tow longer than they were soaring. So, but it was fun. It's like dragging a log behind in the back in a car. You know, it's kind of like just you tugging them left and right and up and down and they catch up with you, and the rope goes slack, and then they slow down, and then the rope bumps, and sometimes you think you're going to take the tail hook off. And, you know, I always thought it was the glider pilots in the back, you know, messing up, and maybe it was me that wasn't doing so good.
Wow.
But it was a good experience.
What plane did you solo in? What was your first solo?
As a Cessna 150.
150?
Yeah.
Back and Bob, you were, you said Aranca?
Aranca Chief, yeah.
Very cool. What about first commercial job? What were your first paid gig that you guys flew?
Well, of course, you know, I was a flight instructor, so we got to fly many little airplanes.
Yeah.
But the first corporate job that I had was I flew a Howard 500.
Oh, very cool.
And a Howard 500 is a very unique airplane. There's not many people that know too much about them. They were built by D. Howard Aircraft down in San Antonio, Texas. and they were a converted PV-1 bomber. And it was a real airplane. It had two R2800 engines on it. That's 2800 or they're 2500 horsepower apiece.
Wow.
And it was pressurized. That's what they in part of the conversion was. They pressurized it, and it would really move. It was a fast airplane, but unfortunately, at the same time, Gulfstream came out with the Gulfstream One, which was a turbine.
A turbine
powered airplane, and it was a much more modern looking airplane. So even though the Howard was faster and the pressurization was actually better. It just didn't make it in the marketplace because this Gulfstream was, like I say, a much more modern-looking airplane, and the Howard was a tail dragger.
It's kind of similar to like a Lockheed Electra or
only bigger.
Yeah, Beech
18.
18, yeah, similar.
But. I was up at Oshkosh this past summer. And the guy brought two of them in.
Oh,
and
wow.
He owns both of them, as a matter of fact. And I got to talk to him. But he just a wealthy guy, and he's got two of them that he flies around. And,
that must be nice.
Yeah. Two of the same
two,
plane.
Yeah. Jeez, a whiz.
That's pretty cool.
But, I mean, they're collector's items now. I mean, I think they're probably – that was probably the last two left because we talked about what serial number the one I flew and – what he had there.
Yeah, I bet that brought back memories.
Oh, it did.
Yeah.
It had a unique situation because of the way it was built. I'm trying to think of this now, maybe make sure I'm correct. If you had a left crosswind, the co-pilot had, and it was a strong crosswind, the co-pilot would land the airplane because what happened was when you'd get full left yoke in it, and forward, you'd hit your, because of the rudder, you'd hit your knee on the, and you couldn't get it in.
Oh,
so
that's
you had
funny.
The co-pilot on the, I'm pretty sure that's right, left crosswind, the co-pilot landed in the right crosswind, of course, the pilot had.
That is funny.
That's pretty funny.
Now, back in the day when you had 900 charts and no weather radar or anything, how did you guys deal with the weather back then? Was it kind of a gamble?
Not well. I mean... Thank God we're still here.
Well, that guy made it in. What was the pilot report on that?
Weather radar was a great invention, let me tell you, because at these lower altitudes, well, even at the higher altitudes, obviously thunderstorms are more severe the higher you get, but you go around them. You don't go through them.
Right.
I mean, and I'm sure Steve has done it too. You all have been caught maybe going through the edge of one and stuff,
right.
And you say, boy, I'll never do that
right.
again. I mean, it happens, but
yeah.
you sure don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
And the new equipment, it really is
is
good because they've improved that so much that they keep you out of it.
Yeah. I mean, even when I was flying in early 90s, the 182 RG we had a small storm scope in it, so even, I felt halfway comfortable. But I just can't imagine back in the day with no, weather of any sort except, whatever you heard, I don't know, on the radio or the reports you got before you took off and, it was a stormy night.
Right.
How you avoid all that.
Well, back then you would get caught more, and now air traffic control is more tuned in with that because they can overlay all those weather maps, and they route traffic around it, so it's all part of their traffic management system
right.
to help keep it flowing as smooth as they can. Of course, we all know that sometimes it breaks down, and if there's a big line of weather that's impacting a large metro area or the New England area or cutting across between Chicago and Atlanta or Dallas, this really messes up the whole system. And what they try to do is just route aircraft around that with the weather that they
right.
have, weather detection systems, the radar and satellite maps and all that. And then that's also carried into the aircraft with downloads of data that we can bring right in on our iPads and overlay our own route on it and strategically think about things hours ahead of time as compared to minutes.
Yeah.
When you get a visual on it, you know, you could say, you know what, there's no reason to continue on this line. Well, let's make a right turn now and go north of Iowa instead of, you know, cutting down through, you know, Missouri or Oklahoma.
Right. I was going to ask you, with today's technology, with, you know, iPads, iPhones, and everything we have, is that starting to incorporate into the flying now?
Oh, yeah. It's infiltrated and quite nicely, and it's very helpful. It brings a great situational awareness and the knowledge base of the action. The accuracy of live weather information is very helpful. Yeah, wow. Live data reports, and then of course, the graphics are phenomenal.
Just charts and...
And, of course, the flight charts are on board and digitally stored on our iPads
And
or embedded in the avionics of the aircraft where you don't really even need an iPad. Now you just bring them up on the screen of the airplane.
And then I think I might have heard you talking before something about between you and the controller, there's text now, too?
Yeah, there's a pilot controller data link communications you know, basically, you get into remote areas that where you would normally use HF radios and talk and try to make your reports across the oceans or in remote areas of the world, that you just can send texts through your avionics system, and you dial them in and you send some initial communications back and forth, and basically kind of a handshake. It says, yes, we're listening, and yes, you know, we know you're listening, and if they need us to do something, they'll tell us. Or if we need a different speed or altitude, then we send a request, and a few minutes later it comes back and says approved, or, you know, got another idea.
Wow, that's
amazing. So it's really, really convenient. Yeah. And that's Bob and I would talk about this years ago. That hey, you know, just think how that's going to, if they had all that data that was just in a computer, would make the whole ocean look like it was live radar.
Yeah.
And that's really what they're
doing.
That's
what they've done.
That's what they've done. And now they're talking. The talking is slowly going away in these areas. And then you've got the data link going on that is human activated, so to speak, on both ends. And eventually, if we were to talk about the future, I mean, that's kind of like, unmanned flying, or automated autonomous flying, you know, that similar to what the drones that are doing now, you know, where they fly them unmanned for, you know, military and for the RC stuff too.
Yeah. Now, do you think you could see here in the next, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years that we're going to be, you know, in the flying cars going to work? Is that possible?
Like the Jetsons?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I don't think so.
You don't see it?
No, I don't see that.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Now, one thing that I think will happen eventually, and I don't know how long this is going to take for it to come about, but most aircraft only have one pilot on board.
I could see that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they probably, if they could, would try to get away with no pilot on board, but... I don't think the public would put up with that. But basically, the pilot's going to monitor the computers up there, because that's somewhat what you do now.
Yeah.
That's coming.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, because even from back like in the Delta days, and you know, the big L-1011s or whatever, where they had the flight engineer and the co-pilot, you know, even that the engineers almost, they're gone now.
Well,
fly-by-wire.
747s only got two.
Yeah.
The new 747s only got two pilots. I mean, they got rid of the engineer a long time ago.
And then I take it most everything now is auto takeoff and auto land, too, on the bigger stuff, right?
Well, they have that, but So, you know, it's look forward 2 decades or 3 decades, and who knows? You know,
anything's possible.
I know that FedEx at one time, and I don't know where they went on this, but FedEx was looking at doing that. They wanted to, they had gone far enough that they'd planned this out. They'd depart off the East Coast and have an aircraft that would go unmanned, and they'd land someplace over, like in the Canary Islands or something, and it would haul freight back and forth as a test bed to see if they could do it. And I don't see any reason they couldn't. But I don't know whatever went, you know, where that ever went or what they.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
I think I read a while back somebody was doing some testing like what you were talking about. And they did it once or twice and was successful, but I don't. Maybe it was FedEx. Maybe my wife works for FedEx. Maybe she was telling me about it. I don't remember, but yeah, that's.
Yeah, I know they were looking into it because one of the things they talked about in this was the fact that they could build a cheaper aircraft because it wouldn't have to be pressurized. All they'd have to do is heat it because they wouldn't want the stuff to. And they could send him out there, and you know, it'd be a lot cheaper aircraft to build.
Right. I just would have been happy if they had GPS when I was learning to fly, you know, and you know, my instructor, he was kind of hardcore. I remember he made me do a night VFR cross country into Washington Dulles one night for my commercial. I was ready to kill him, you know. But
what about going back to first planes? What was Dad? What was your first commercial gig, or what kind of plane did you fly on your first corporate job?
Well, that would have been a, I would say the there were small jobs that you'd do here and there and contract work in Cessna 210s and 206s and Pipers and stuff like that. But the,
any 414s or 421s?
I had a 421 experience.
I got some 421 time.
Yeah, I had a couple years in one of those. And but the Beach Bonanza A36 was probably my first real corporate job that we used to fly around the Great Lakes region and in Midwest, and spent a lot of time in that aircraft learning a lot.
It was in a V-tail, was it?
No, it was an A-36 is a straight tail, six passenger.
Very cool.
That was F-33 was my first high-performance plane. You know, going from a Cessna to that thing was like going from a Volkswagen to a Porsche. You know, that thing was awesome.
Yeah, they were fun airplanes.
Yeah.
So what did you two, Bob and you, Dad, what did you guys fly when you were doing the majority of your flying together?
Well, it was at the time came on board, it was they had Challengers.
Both did we have the Challengers?
Both Challengers.
I'm trying to think when.
Yeah, they were both Challengers, like aircraft.
Bombardier.
Yeah, six Challenger 601s.
Yeah.
Which is, for those of you who don't know, it's kind of like a business jet. How many passengers?
12.
12 is what we had our setup for.
12 passengers.
I think it could be configured to 19.
Right. Big enough fuselage to stand up in, right?
Yeah, that was the first wide body corporate airplane is what that's the way they could.
That's how they built it.
Yeah.
So you guys did the majority of your traveling in the Challenger then?
Yeah.
We did. And now when I first went with the company, we had a Gulfstream 1 and a Gulfstream 2.
Oh, okay.
And so I got to fly both those airplanes, and that the Gulfstream 2, you know, we talk about airplanes you'd like to fly. That airplane probably was the most fun airplane I ever flew.
Really? And that is the 2, is it a jet?
It was a jet. Okay. And it had the two engines on it were Rolls-Royce engines, and it had same thrust to weight ratio as an F4.
Wow.
And it would perform like that. Let me tell you. I mean,
that sounds fun.
When you could fly it with no passengers on board
and very little fuel,
it would really perform.
Wow,
that's pretty awesome. What about you? What about you, Dad? What do you think your favorite plane or most fun plane that you've ever flown?
Well, you know, really, it's like whatever you're flying at the time is the best plane in the whole world. It really doesn't matter what it is, and you know,
the one you're flying right now is
the best
which
so far.
You got rid of not flying the Challenger as much.
We have a Challenger, and then now we have a Gulfstream 550 that we also operate, and that's just a great airplane.
Yeah, in my book, that's the best corporate jet out there today. I mean, that thing is just
well, they just
crazy.
Came out with the 650.
Oh, did they really?
I haven't flown one of those, but. I hear that's a very, very nice aircraft, too.
Wow.
It'll be similar, other than it's a wide body.
Sure.
Yeah.
Wide body.
Same engines, a little more thrust and some different modifications to the systems. And pressurization's a little different. Range, fuel, endurance, that sort of thing. They've increased that. But
what's the range on, like, your 550 that you fly now?
It'll fly almost 15 hours, you know, on a perfect day. You know, but typically you'd feel comfortable any day of the week with a 12.5 hour leg and have plenty of reserves to any place and feel comfortable being able to go somewhere else.
Which 12.5 hours, what's your cruising speed?
Mach 0.85.
So it's pretty far.
So that thing's pretty much can go anywhere in the world, basically.
Right. Yeah, if you wanted to go 15 hours, you couldn't go at Mach 8.5.
You know,
if you need it, depends on how much fuel reserve you needed at the other end. You know, if you were going to go 12.5 hours and you needed some fuel reserve, you wouldn't fly it at Mach 8.5. You'd probably go at 8.3 or even 8.0 if you needed to. That way it just increases your fuel on the other end for more options.
Yeah.
You know, it's good to go in, especially when you go that far, you're in a foreign country and the weather is different in these places. And you just, you know, without fuel, you have no options.
Right.
And
sure.
There's no outlandings like in a glider or a balloon for that.
Yeah, right. What's the farthest you went one time, hour-wise, do you think?
14 hours and 45 minutes.
Yep. And was from where to where?
That was from Cape Town to San Juan.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. Which you just you recently just went around the world in one trip for the first time.
Well,
it was last year, multiple legs.
Done that twice. We've done it twice so far. And you make stops along the way. Some are for the destinations that you're going to, and others are for fuel stops to get there or back from.
So you leave the East Coast and
you go make a stop in Europe, and then from there you can go it's one stop anywhere in the world is what it is.
Yeah.
I mean that's what it comes down to. For the most part, you know, within reason.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, we're talking all these airplane model numbers. For those of you who don't know, I'll be posting pictures or links or at least something to give you a visual reference of what kind of planes and stuff we're talking about. And the show notes can always be found on flighttest.com. Just go to the article for this specific podcast for the show notes. So,
The other question I had, like, I'm sure, you know, whether you're traveling to Europe or whatever, do you usually have 2, 3, 4, 5 day layovers?
Sometimes you do. And nowadays, business model has changed. And it depends on the type of travel, for what reason that people are traveling. But and the type of travel pattern that is in the culture of an organization or the owners. And so, you know, in today's business, and to maintain a competitive edge, you know, there's no long layovers anymore. Not like in years past, where, you know, sometimes you'd get to a spot and you'd be there for different reasons.
Right.
So
now, just
that,
say
that doesn't mean that other companies and other people all over the world that go someplace and sometimes they leave the plane and they, you know, where the folks are, and then they come back on the airlines and go back and get the plane a month later.
Well, that's why I was going to ask you, like, just for instance, say you went to Rome and you were there 3 days. Do you get to go explore the city?
Well, you have some layover time.
Of course.
It's
part of the bennies.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow, that's awesome.
So you guys don't have to go to the business meeting that your passengers are all going to?
No, not very often. I mean, there has been occasion when they've invited us to go with them to visit maybe something special. And did you get to go to the, where was that, Todd? No, you got to go when you went to the christening of the ship, aircraft carrier.
Oh, yeah, right.
What was that?
That was the Reagan.
Ronald Reagan.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, 76. And when it was on in the process of being built, those things take 5 years. And along the way, towards the end of its build process, there's an opportunity for family and friends. And it was a kind of a show-and-tell cruise for the day that they were able to, you know, go out and kind of a little bit of a shakedown, you know, run with the ship, and then bring it back into port that evening. So that was a great opportunity.
Did they launch any fighters?
yeah, they did. As a matter of fact, yeah.
Wow. F-18s.
Yep.
That had to be intense.
Oh, no doubt.
It was loud.
Yeah, I bet. Wow, that's awesome. Anything else? I got a couple more, but
yeah, go ahead.
We could go on for hours, yeah. I think. Bob, I wanted to know, since you've been flying RC for so long, what maybe in the last 5 years, 10 years, or whatever, what do you think is the biggest advancement in RC?
Well, you know, that's – I would say, first of all, the radios, and then – batteries, probably.
And the LiPo batteries?
LiPo batteries and the...
2.4 gigahertz radio? Is that what you think?
Well, that's another one, yeah. But just computer.
Oh, I see.
The computer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, when we went to the... where you could program the radio to do things, that was a big step. The batteries, the brushless motors, I mean, for electrics.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think about what's... and there's another big turnaround is the electrics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could see where probably nitro is, you wonder how long that's going to be around. It's going to be either gas or electric.
Yeah, I think nitro is going by the wayside, especially now we've talked before, they're getting these 10cc, 15cc gas, you know, it used to be nitro, now they're converting them all over to gas. So yeah, I think nitro is kind of, you know, and who wants to pay $40 for a gallon of fuel now?
Yeah, no kidding.
Huh, that's interesting.
But there's been many, let's put it that way.
Yeah,
But you know, and this battery thing, I don't think that's going anywhere, but it's going to get better.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, with all the cell phones and the laptops and iPads and all this stuff they're running on battery power now.
Yeah.
We're going to see a big jump in that coming up. And the nanotech thing.
Yeah.
I was reading about battery life. Excuse me.
What are your guys' thoughts on all the rules and regulations or lack thereof when it comes to just the hobby in general, but primarily like this FPV flight and long range flight that people have been doing? I think Eric was saying like 2015 that
supposedly
they're going to get their ducks in a row and regulate, you know, that aspect of the hobby. Also, commercial use of flying aerial, you know, cameras around, you know, via RC, multi-rotor, or whatever it may be. What are your guys' thoughts? Do you think that there should be strict regulation on certain aspects of the hobby?
Well, there's going to be some, I guarantee you. I mean, it's going to come. And unfortunately, it's going to come from some of the people that I would say are not very professional. Let's put it that way.
It's going to come because of the people who are goofing off and
exactly.
doing dumb things.
You know, they buy one and they can, you know, go out and fly it, and they're going to do things that they shouldn't do, and and then, you know, then the regulations come.
Right. What do you think they should do, or what in your mind, what would be some good regulations to put in for, you know, like this FPV and this long range stuff?
Well, restrict it from full scale, you know, and you know, regular air traffic. I mean, you got to separate the two. They can't have uncontrolled in with the controlled stuff, and it's got to be predictable to keep that safe and to protect the flying public. And then probably, you know, I suppose densely populated areas versus sparsely populated areas, and restricting them away from, you know, towns and putting them out into the country area setting, so that there would be less opportunity for a problem. Maybe identifying that stuff, those areas of flight on a flight chart, so everyone knew that where it was and that it was, you know, that was there. You'd avoid it, you know, restricting altitudes, flight to, and that sort of thing is probably where you know would be a likely start.
Yeah,
and maybe required training and knowledge, so that the
license
maybe some.
Depending on what you're going to do.
I was going to say, maybe if you're doing some, you know, higher altitude or longer range stuff, you had to have some kind of knowledge.
Some knowledge.
Yeah.
Even like commercial use, if you once it's regulated, if you,
see,
I don't know.
My thing with the commercial use is I think if you're doing commercial, you're going to be more not flying as high or more centrally located.
I guess thinking populated areas, I guess.
Yeah, I can see that.
If you're, you know, I don't know. And obviously there you probably need like – I think if you're going to profit off of it, you know, you should have to have a, you know, some kind of license, prove yourself, prove to, you know, the FAA or whoever it may be that you're worthy and knowledgeable and you're you know, able to operate, you know, whatever it is, whether it's a multi-rotor or not, you know, safely and effectively, mm-hmm. Whether it's logging a flight plan or, you know, doing proper pre-flights, because if you're doing I don't know, insurance. Mm-hmm. It's I don't know. It's a huge undertaking.
Yeah, I was going to say, so many, you know, where do you draw the line? You know, if you do something like this and they make you license and you go out and you have a failure and hurt somebody, is it, you know, is that just something to fall back on you because you're the pilot?
Yeah. You know? Guess you'd lose your wings.
Yeah, I don't. That's a touchy subject.
Well, we've already seen it now in the Olympics. Where they were chasing those guys down the hill with the snowboarders down the hill with those multi-rotors.
I did see that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just the beginning.
Right.
That's just the beginning. Now, but you're right. I think, I don't know whether you license the machine so that we know it has the capability of doing what the guy says it's they're going to do with it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Autonomous recovery, so if it does get out of control, then it takes care of itself.
Right.
Yeah.
Which we can do nowadays.
Right. So that stabilization and such, that's another piece of technology that's come a long way. And I don't know anything about it because I haven't dabbled in it. But, you know, that where the with the gyros and stabilization of all sizes of of aircraft like that, where you can bring in autonomous recovery, be one thing, a redundancy, you know, reversion back to something that you can go back to that keeps people safe.
Right. And we had Eric Monroe in here last podcast, and he kind of brought up a good point. He was telling us that the Discovery Channel had two helicopter crashes? You know, they did all their filming with the helicopters back then at the time, and after they had two crashes, they said, that's it, no more, we're done, we don't want to deal with it, we don't want the liability. Well, now with the UAVs or the drones now, and seeing what they can do and how they can film, now they've brought it back. So now they're doing, you know, more air-to-air stuff, you know, just
with UAVs.
Yeah, with UAVs, because it's so much safer and, you know, obviously cost-wise is way cheaper.
Right, especially since they're not allowed to pay them.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think, you know, there's really a lot of advantages to it, but like Bob, you were saying, there's the disadvantages are people that don't care or not taking this, you know, seriously. And it's going to hurt somebody or hurt something or, you know, I think that's where the problem lies.
Unfortunately, that's probably that's usually where the rulemaking starts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have an accident and then somebody jumps up and says, we got to do something about it. Well, we saw that already. Just think what, I can't think of his name, but the fellow that owns Amazon did when he said that they were going to have, and all these congressmen, you know, we got to regulate this. Yeah. We can't do that.
Man. Right. And it's funny because everybody's jumping on that bandwagon. Yeah, it's just for publicity. You know, they had the beer one out of, Wisconsin or Minnesota, and then they just had the other guy over Valentine's Day that was going to deliver roses with the UAV and, you know.
Domino's did it with pizza.
Yeah. So I think now they're just kind of using it for advertising.
Well, I think, that the guy from Amazon did that for a reason. I just watched a video about one of their warehouses and how they automate their warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
When you see that, I mean, it just blew my mind of what they're doing with all these robots in this warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see, I mean, he's thinking, I'm going to throw this out there and start, you know, just letting people know what we think we can do with these things. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Yeah. Probably not anytime like super soon, but eventually, I mean, you look down the road, how far the hobby's come in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I think, you know, 15, 20 years from now, it could very well be a reality.
Yeah. We're probably going to be sitting in our living room flying around with goggles on, probably.
Yeah.
Bob, what do you think? I wanted to ask you too. The Durafly Retro line, they're bringing back some of these planes from, I don't know, back in the 60s and early 70s, and now they're bringing them back into foam, like the Durafly Retro. They got the Junior that's coming back. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen the Junior.
Phil. I'll pull it up here.
They replicated the what do they call that, Alex? It's the Junior, but what's the full name? Do you know?
Retro Junior.
Yeah, the Retro Junior. You know, that was a stick and tissue plane back in the day. They brought it back in full foam. It has a dummy motor on it. But the cool thing is they actually replicated the wood and everything in the paint. So if you look at it, it actually looks like a stick and you know, stick.
It's
and
got a fake little nitro
on it, too. So now they're bringing these back, you know, into foam. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't have any problem with foam. You know, obviously I bought a carbon cup. But I know a lot of the fellas. There's a fella that we fly with. He goes, I would never have one of those things. You know, it's foam and... You know, that's he won't fly electric, and, you know, and all that stuff. So, I mean, there's certain people that still won't embrace it, but I think it's a great idea. You know, that obviously those were great airplanes as far as trainer type airplanes.
Right.
You know, they did a good job with that because they were free flights basically.
Yeah,
they put controls on.
Yeah, and they put ailerons on this one too.
Well, that would make it even better.
Yeah. It's a good-looking airplane.
Well, it's a great way to hold on to the legends, you
nostalgia.
Know, and the classics, and the history, and the roots of where we are today.
Yeah.
And to think, well, that design is in a lot of ways not much different than today, but in a lot of ways it's way different.
So, yeah.
And for the young people to see how things used to be in a modern mock-up type plane, that's a great idea.
Do you, Bob, see a lot of the guys that used to fly the big nitro or gas planes? Do you see them converting over to foam and brushless setups?
I don't think so. The guys are going to fly gas. The guys that fly the big stuff, and you know, I don't think they're going to. Although most of those people that are doing that do have electric airplanes.
Uh-huh.
They have something that they're flying that's electric that they can just throw in the air real quick, but. We have a fella at the field that's got an old-timer, and I don't know where he got it. I think he bought it at a swap meet. Big old thing, and it's all covered. Looks, you can see, you know, the see-through covering on it. And somebody did a beautiful job building it. It looks similar to that. And he put electric motor in it, and it is sort of fun to fly. He's let me fly it a couple times, and... Obviously, on windy days, it's not too fun, but it's on most of the days, it's fun to fly. The thing floats around. And
yeah, Josh and I were kicking around the idea of doing an episode of converting old-timer balsa, because he's got a lot of his father's old models, because he'd been a modeler for years, and he's got a bunch of them sitting around. So we were kicking around episode ideas, as we always do. So let us know if that's something you'd want to see, because... We can definitely do it.
I think that would be a good idea because what you go through to convert one over to electric.
Yeah, that would be cool to see.
Because he told me that he has some real old models.
No kidding.
Kind of like they look kind of like the Retro Junior from Hobby King, but it's like the legitimate balsa buildup one. So I keep trying to remind him to bring that in, but he always forgets.
Huh. Awesome. Anything else? Anybody got any other questions? We've been rolling. How long have we been going?
Almost
an hour and a half here.
Yeah.
Got any questions for us? No, I'm just kidding.
I tell you what, I you do a nice job with this.
I
appreciate you having me here.
It's been fun.
Yeah,
it's
excited you guys came back in, I guess I should say. You know, we did the first one. We had, you know, Josh here too, but it was really good. But I think this one's good too.
Yeah, which we keep probing and asking you guys what your thoughts are on incorporating more full-scale flight into flight tests. This obviously would be another good time. So let us know if you want more of this kind of stuff. I know, you know, I'm a student pilot. Chris has flown. Josh Bixler, you know, he's a pilot. He's actually building a plane. So we definitely have the capability and the people to start incorporating full-scale flight. If that's something you'd be interested in, leave us a comment or you know, shoot us an email or whatever, and voice your opinion, because everything that we do ultimately is derivative of what you guys want. So, yeah, let us know. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we're going to get out of here, and I need some more coffee to stay awake, or I'm not going to make it home. It's been a long day. But, hey, thanks, guys, for listening. We really appreciate it. If you have any questions or anything, comments, anything you want to see on the show, hit us up on FT After Hours or shoot me an email at chris@flighttest.com. Other than that, we'll be back here in a couple weeks, hopefully. So. Yeah. And I really appreciate you guys coming in.
Yeah, we're glad to be here. Thank you. We appreciate you having us.
All right. So we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks, guys.
Was the recorder on this time?
I think so. All right. We're out of here.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you.